center.com.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with environmental historian John Perlin. He has written several books. One is about the way that people have relied in through most of human history on wood, both as an energy source and as a building material, and as how sort of makes the argument that, in fact, if we didn't have trees, maybe we wouldn't even have a civilization. That book is A Forest Journey, The Story of Wood and Civilization. He has also written a couple of books about solar power, From Space to Earth, The Story of Solar Electricity is one. He is here visiting the campus to give a talk, spend some time. He'll actually be spending a couple of days here on the campus. He'll be giving a talk on Friday, tomorrow, on the subjects that he deals with in A Forest Journey. You are also doing a talk about solar power, right?
At
Allen Hall tonight at 7:30. I'm sure that either of these talks are open to anybody who would like to attend. All they have to do is go there to Turner Hall either at noon on Friday, or I'm sure you could stop by Allen Hall tonight at 7:30 in their main lounge and hear John Perlin. And on this program as well, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. John Perlin has worked as a principal investigator for the National Renewable Energy Lab and the National Center for Photovoltaics, gathering of exhibit and historical material for the 50th anniversary of the crystalline silicon solar cell by Bell Labs. He has also worked on a film, Power from the Sun, A Century Since Einstein's Photon, 50 Years of Modern Photovoltaics. And we're really pleased that he could be here and spend some time talking with us. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. It's good to have you here. We appreciate
it. It's beautiful. You have a ideal day for solar energy. If you were monomaniacal and thought only about photovoltaic solar cells, you would be in heaven.
Let's talk a little bit about, because I know in your books you have also looked at the long history of the exploitation of sun as energy source. And I guess one of the things to acknowledge is that, you know, certainly now there are architects and designers today that are trying to take advantage of using passive solar to heat spaces. What's, I guess, striking is that people have been doing that pretty much almost as far back as we know.
Well, that's how the solar book ties in with the wood book, is when investigating people using, feeling compelled to use solar energy for house heating, the reason was is they were running out of wood fuel. And so once I finished the first solar book called A Golden Thread, 2,500 Years of Solar Architecture and Technology, I decided because wood was the principal building material and fuel, it seemed so parallel to oil that it seemed possibly to be extremely relevant to our present situation.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, again, this we're staying for a second on the issue of wood, but I think the other thing that's really striking when you take a look at that book, there is concern and has been some concern now for decades about the issue of deforestation. Well, it looks as if deforestation has been a part of human history also, that because people relied so heavily on that resource, it's not just within the past few decades that we've been going out and clear cutting. Well, that goes back a long time. And in fact, some people have traced the collapse of civilizations to the fact that they cut down all their trees.
Well, trees serve multiple purposes. For example, for the Mesopotamians, they would cut down the trees on the mountaintops. And once you expose the mountaintops to the weather, the soil comes down into the rivers, and then it would clog their agricultural irrigation canals. And worse, it brought the salt of the from the rock into the rivers too. Mm-hmm. So along with the rafting of logs came the salinity, which eventually destroyed the productivity of the soils in southern Mesopotamia. Mm-hmm. I think it's really difficult when we look at Iraq, for example, and we look at the mountains above in Iran. Those were once the great cedar forests of that part of the world as greatly forested, say, as the Pacific Northwest today.
Yeah. Was it always the case that people tended to look at that resource and just thought that it was inexhaustible?
Well, that's the whole problem, is people just think of their current situation. And actually, for example, the Mesopotamians, they had toponyms, which means they named each area for the resource. And they called the Cedar Mountain for Iran, the mountains above Iran. Then it moved to the area we call Turkey today. So it was always, and this is what's happened with deforestation, it's always been a move westward as people hack down the trees, including in this country. For example, Illinois even, about 40% of Illinois was well-wooded before the American settlers came.
Mm-hmm. And still today, for an awful lot of people in the world, wood is their primary source of, burning wood is their primary source of energy, wood, the energy for heating and for cooking.
Right? Well, actually, for I think about at least 40% of the world, people rely, are still in what I would call a biomass age, mm-hmm. Where they're totally dependent for cooking and for heating. And you see the same story as I outline, as I discuss in the book, 5,000 years ago. I've seen this with my very eyes in, say, Mexico, where people are carrying wood either on donkeys or charcoal on donkeys and bringing it down from further and further distances to provide themselves with heat.
Yeah. Well, that I guess can take us back to solar energy, because obviously here there is a need, there is a great need for energy. And a lot of people say that that solar is something that it's there and we certainly should be exploiting it. We should be putting more effort into developing that. Just going back to the question, I'm really interested in how far back the idea of using what we would call passive solar design goes back. Certainly goes back to the Greeks and to the Romans.
Well, actually, when we did the book, it went to it was kind of funny. We thought, wow, we made this amazing discovery that people were using solar energy 100 years ago. And then I met a architect, and he said, oh, you think you're onto something very old. When I was in graduate school, there was this article you should read about heating baths in Rome with the sun. And then going into the classics department, and I said, oh, if you think Rome was innovative, you should go back to the city of Olympus, where the entire city was planned for every house to take advantage of the sun during wintertime. And then I discovered that ancient China, thousands of years before, built on the solar building principle, where houses, streets are laid out so every house can maximize a southern exposure.
So just in simple terms, what does that mean? If you had the opportunity to build a house and start from nothing, build from the ground up, what would be the important things that you would want to do?
Well, it depends where you live. For example, if you're south of the equator, the sun's always in the north at noon. So you would face your house north. So what's so stimulating for me about solar energy is you have to think of your locale. You can't just do a cookie cutter. So you have to think of the climate and you have to think of where you are. So, for example, here, the facade in this building is beautiful because it faces south. And it's very warm today because we're having a very nice day today, a very sunny day. Mm-hmm. So I'm very glad to be here. Mm. So you would build the house so that in Illinois, for example, you would have the largest exposure would be to the south. By exposure, I mean the glassed area. You would try to minimize the east and the west because that's when you get the hot summer sun. You would try to insulate very well the north because you don't get any solar value during the wintertime. So that's how you would begin it. Of course, you would think of insulation. You would think of building material. You would think of ways of using what they call solar mass to absorb the heat, mm-hmm. so it would remain hot during the nighttime. You would also think of possibly curtains, to keep the heat in during the nighttime. All those things. And also you would have eaves. So during the summertime, the sun at solar noon would not come into the house.
Yeah, because there you're getting to the point where the sun is the rays are the most direct because it's highest in the sky.
Right. In fact, Socrates said it best. He said a house with south with eaves and a large south facing facade is the ideal house because in winter the low sun comes rushing into the house, and during the summertime the sun is over our heads and shaded.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is John Perlin. As I mentioned, he's written a couple of books about solar energy. One, A Golden Thread, 2,500 Years of Solar Architecture and Technology. The other, From Space to Earth, The Story of Solar Electricity. He also has authored a book, Forest Journey, The Story of Wood and Civilization. And we just touched on that a little bit right at the beginning. That does go back to the ancient world and to take a look at the importance of wood as a resource, as an energy source, as a building material, and what happens when people cut down all their trees.
And also I'd like to mention one of the reasons why a forest journey is so relevant to the solar part also is the fact that deforestation, especially in the United States during the 19th century, is and the conversion of the land to agriculture until 1970 was the major cause of global warming. And one of the reasons we're interested in solar energy is the fact that the electricity is produced without any carbon emissions. In fact, most of the electricity today is generated by coal, which is the biggest producer of greenhouse gases. So the solar electricity is allowing us to avoid carbon emission while we can still have the benefits of a modern society.
Yeah. You're talking about some of the basic principles of passive solar design, and that would be the kind of thing that it's kind of hard to retrofit for that. You could do that if you were starting a building from the beginning, but, well, just having said that, if we from now on, if we in new construction employed those kind of principles, is there some sort of number that you can put on what that would mean in terms of, say, reducing our energy use, particularly for heating in the cold periods of the year, in places where it does get very cold in the wintertime. Just what that would mean if when we built new buildings, we used those principles?
Well, we have to include summertime, too. Using those principles, we would avoid something like, I have it in my book, but off the cuff, about 10 times the amount of energy used for heating and cooling. We have to emphasize cooling also, which is one of the most is one of the greatest demands for electricity. In fact, that's why in California we're right now having a very progressive initiative to use solar electricity with very, very generous incentives, because our sun resource in California and in the Midwest is almost in sync with the increasing use of electricity during the year. So as we increase our use of electricity, we're also getting more of our solar resource. So in July, August, September, when no one has any electrons in the lines, your solar panels are there using tremendous amount of solar energy available to avoid brownouts and blackouts.
This is here. Now, you're pointing to what a lot of people think really is the big potential, and that is using the sun to generate electricity
right.
with the photovoltaic cell. That is where you actually turn the energy from the light of the sun, you actually can take that and turn that into electricity.
It's actually very elegant in that it directly converts light into electricity without any moving parts, without any other conversions. It goes directly from sunlight into electricity. No moving parts, no loss of materials. It's the first quantum power source.
Now, this is not a new technology. When was the photo cell invented?
Well, there were two steps. In the 1870s, when they were laying the transatlantic cable, they discovered that the element selenium was a solar reactive. Mm-hmm. So then they did various experiments and discovered that it created an electromotive force with light. Unfortunately, the material was not efficient. Efficiency means the difference between the amount of sunlight coming in and the amount of energy you can take out of it. Then with the transistor revolution in the 1940s, they discovered the material silicon. If you put certain impurities in it, became a very powerful device for conducting electricity. And that's why the silicon revolution has transformed the world. Hmm. Now, as part of that revolution came the silicon solar cell, which is the solar cell that is today used, for example, in your meteorology devices by your radio station, which could and does very efficiently transform sunlight into electricity. So it's been around for about the very effective solar cell has been around for 53 years now.
Yeah. So I suppose that, and I have a, I promise I have a caller here, I won't make them wait forever, but I guess that invites the question, now that it's, we've known how to do this for about 50 years, why isn't it that every inch of every roof in the United States is not covered with solar cells, and we're putting them everywhere and taking advantage of the fact that we could just be soaking up all this power and turning it into electricity?
Well, for one thing, and this is what I always try to do, is to show things in a historical context. 54 was a very auspicious year in that the United States was trying to sell the peaceful atom, atoms for peace, mm-hmm. in order to it's basically a artifact of the Cold War. Because the Soviet Union, the old Soviet Union, was very effectively using the fact that the United States was testing above ground to garner, you know, ideological support against America. So America invented the idea of the peaceful atom, and then it spread throughout the world. And the result, of course, the peaceful atom is our situation in Iran, ironically. That's one of the end results. And so the solar cell invention was overshadowed by this very governmental propaganda for the peaceful atom, because the peaceful solar cell had nothing to do for our foreign policy. So it was this bad year. In 1954, the solar cell was invented just as the United States embarked on this huge propaganda campaign for the peaceful atom that involved the whole world, the United Nations, everybody.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is John Perlin. He has visited here to the University of Illinois. Is sponsored in part by the folks in Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences. He'll be giving a couple of talks. He'll be talking about the story of wood and civilization, which is the story of his book, A Forest Journey, on Friday at noon in Turner Hall on the U of I campus. And then also he'll be giving a talk about solar power, and that will be tonight at 7:30 in the main lounge at Allen Hall. And I think anybody who is interested should feel free to stop in. He's also authored a couple of books dealing with solar, the history of solar power, A Golden Thread, 2,500 Years of Solar Architecture and Technology, and the other is titled From Space to Earth, The Story of Solar Electricity. Questions are certainly welcome. We have somebody here who is standing by, ready to go. Others can call in. Very easy. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Charleston, line 4. Hello.
Yes, Mr. Perlin, I have heard you, I think, on this very station or perhaps program maybe 10 or 12 years ago. Or more, and that's where I first heard of your book, The Forest Journey, and I got it and read it, and I was amazed by it, and am to this day, and I think that a genius such as yours, you should be president, But anyway, I guess the reason for my call is I understand how we're socially organized, the economics and the human social organization and the powers that direct all of that, and how it operates. And the first thing that occurs to me is the increase in population every year. And now with 6 billion people on the earth, and the way we are socially organized, you know, in private houses and in different parts of the world where, you know, solar is a day-by-day thing, such as some parts of Africa. But in Canada and the north of the U.S. and all that, you know, where we have to, this weather, for one, you know, my power bill, when I get that, I'm afraid I'm going to be shocked. But in, you know, everybody will. But in any case, if how will that play out? I mean, the book on deforestation, you know, and the old growth trees that are now just memories, and if we keep that up, how long can that be sustained?
Well, for example, deforestation, surprisingly, is the second largest cause of global warming at this moment. Far greater, and this really surprised me when I saw the numbers, than transportation. So if we continue to deforest, we're going to have more and more problems that we're seeing at the moment. We're seeing the proof of the global warming model, which is not very happy. So to answer the question, my belief is that if somehow we counterintuitively paid people a living wage not to do anything in forests and just allow the forest to sequester carbon, that would be far better than cutting down those trees. Now, secondly, in California, for example, California Public Utilities Commission has initiated an incredibly powerful solar incentive program where people like yourself would find it economic to install panels. But I've been told in Illinois there isn't much happening as far as financial incentives. So if people start to work their legislature and say, look, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger is not your radical left, and yet he twofold has gotten the required the utilities cannot use coal to generate electricity.
Yes.
That's happened. It's gone into effect in February 1st of this year. And also January 1st, a college, a university like here at University of Illinois, can get 50 cents a kilowatt hour for the solar electricity they produce with photovoltaics. And what this has done is in the summertime, about 16 megawatts of photovoltaics is going to be bidded on for the universities in the California public school system.
Yes. Could I add one other thing?
Sure.
I live in a little town called Charleston, Mattoon, we're 10 miles apart, and I have both gotten on fairly good information, and I see it happening. In Mattoon, there was a program that the city, the trees that were growing on city property, boulevards, and all that, there were 8,000 trees that were going to be cut down. And then, you know, they mulch up that stump. And in Charleston, where I live, there's been no information about that program per se. But increasingly, our little town is being deforested, too, on city property. Old growth trees, the oaks and maples, the hard maple, which is a good sturdy tree. And I see you cannot, the boulevard effect of the city streets, especially in the old part of town, is being cut down. I talked to our local mayor, and he said, well, yes, that is happening. You know, we see that in different places. But for everyone we cut down, we plant two. And then he followed it by saying, well, of course, it'll take 100 years for the tree to grow. Meanwhile, you know, all the events between then and now, and a lot of it, these Bradford pears and stuff like that, which is, you know, they're vulnerable in this part of the country. And thank you very much.
Well, I'd like to say that urban forestry is probably one of the most important innovations we should be looking at, because urban forestry lowers the temperatures in the cities. So what it does, it makes it more comfortable in the summertime, especially with global warming coming on. And also it reduces the CO2 in two ways, not only by storing the carbon, but also by reducing the power loads for air conditioning. And also it keeps the city cleaner because the leaves act like a filter for the pollution. And so it's so horrible, and I hear about this everywhere, that people are cutting down the city trees rather than encouraging urban forestry, which could really make a city much more enjoyable to live.
So are they doing that just because the kind of maintenance that the trees need in terms of periodic trimming, about the fact that you may have issues with power lines, all that kind of stuff, is that the cities think that they're saving themselves money by cutting down the bigger, older, mature trees and replacing them with trees that are only 6 feet tall?
I have no idea what, because every city probably is different. For some reason in the United States, there's been this war against the trees, like the last 100 years. Like John Muir said, any fool can cut down a tree because they can't run away.
Wise man, that John Muir. We're a little bit past our midpoint here. Let me just very quickly again introduce our guest. He's an environmental writer. His name is John Perlin. He has written the book A Forest Journey, The Story of Wood and Civilization, which takes a look at the effects of wood as used for building and fuel, and also of this link between the development of civilization and deforestation. He's also written a couple of books about solar power, and he's here visiting the campus to talk about both of these things, and I'll give you the information again a little bit later in the second half of the show. We have some other callers, and I'd like to include them. Going next to someone in Urbana, and that's line one. Hello. Is there a caller there in Urbana, line one? Go ahead.
Sorry.
Yes. Yes.
Got a little choked. I hope you don't mind if I introduce some technical questions. This is often kind of dull and overlooked, but I've always wanted it as a kind of foundation. Am I right in remembering that the typical gasoline-powered engine thermodynamically is about 15% efficient? That is, the energy of the exploding gasoline is captured in motion just about 15%.
I think it's between 10 and 15%.
Okay. And that a typical steam-powered electric generator, I'm not sure whether it's both for nuclear and coal, but a steam-powered generator is about one-third efficient. One-third of the heat generated winds up actually as electricity delivered to the home.
Well, no, that's incorrect. It's one-third of the electricity at the power station is produced from that coal, but then you have major transmission losses.
I see.
Which is about in a good system is about from 20 to 30%, but in most of the world, like in the developing world, it can be up to 60% lost in transmission.
That you lose it between the power?
Oh, yeah.
Between where it's generated and then at the end user?
Oh, yeah. In fact, and then if you're, using a incandescent light bulb, which is only uses 5% of the electricity that comes to you to actually provide lighting, you do the math, it's, you only get about 1% of the initial, like, coal, the energy equivalent in the coal to the end electrical use.
So that prompts the question first, what is the more or less a consensus efficiency now of a solar panel?
Okay. For residential, the best solar cells are about 21% efficient. The best solar cells for space is about 37-38% efficient. The best cells in the laboratory are now over 40% efficient.
And then the question becomes price. Someone alluded to a price before per kilowatt hour of electricity delivered. What is the comparable price? And it's got to be hard to figure because the initial installation has to be so high. But if you assume a 10-year period, install it, and then use it for 10 years, what's the estimate for a good price for a kilowatt hour of electricity from a solar panel?
Well, see, first of all, it depends on the amount of solar radiation you're getting because that is part of the equation. And also it depends on policy. For example, in California, as I mentioned, January 1st, we have incredible incentives from the government. So it becomes a very economical choice. And then also a very interesting situation where you have third-party investors who use all the various tax incentives to put on a building the photovoltaic cells modules for free, and then they charge 10% less for the amount of for the rate you're paying at presently from the traditional utility. So, for example, in California, they're going for these third-party investment programs. So they're never they're always paying 10% less than what they would have to pay from a regular utility.
And that's only likely to get cheaper if researchers continue?
Not only if researchers continue, which is as the solar industry has been growing leaps and bounds, and what that always does, success breeds more success because more people want to jump in who are very intelligent because they'll get rewarded financially. You know, companies like DuPont, like Dow Chemical, are getting very involved in the entire stream of the development of solar cells. One of the really optimistic parts is the feedstock, the original processing of the silicon itself is really getting cheaper because they're finding investment that allows them to use a much less expensive methods of taking the quartzite, which is the starting point of a solar cell, and then they have to reduce oxide of the silicon dioxide, to be technical for you,
right,
to silicon, and then they have to remove the impurities, which are only a few parts per million, to make it into a solar material that will produce enough electricity.
May I ask a second technical question?
Of course, I love it.
I don't want to hold up anybody else.
No,
though.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
One of the surprises when I first began reading about the cost of electrical generation is that nobody has an effective storage. You can't just run a really high efficient generator, coal-fired, nuclear, whatever, overnight and store up the electricity so that in the heat of the day when everyone wants to run their air conditioners, you now have stored, cheaply produced electricity. In fact, generators have to kick up when the demand kicks up. So with solar and otherwise, have you heard of any good storage technology so that places like the Mojave Desert could run almost year-round and in some way store that power and then release it when the demand is greatest?
Well, what they do today, and this is very clever, is they have changed the whole paradigm. Earlier, it was always the solar, the electrical generator, and the consumer. In California, for example, there's an interchange, an interaction between consumer who becomes a producer, and they provide the electrons, as you said, when there's not enough in the grid during the summertime. And then in the evening, say, the grid, which is still producing, provides the electricity or the battery to the consumer. So we have this interaction now between the consumer and the who becomes also a producer and the traditional utility.
And that way there's a partnership.
Exactly.
I see. But no magic storage facility.
No, but that's being developed, too. In fact, there might be, in the next 3 or 4 weeks, a very interesting announcement by Philips Electronics and Armstrong, the people who do ceilings, of the wireless house, which will really innovate things as far as... I'd like to get into the fact that solar cells produce direct current and our appliances today, like our computers, are naturally direct current. But because we rely on alternating current, which was developed before the transistor revolution, so we have to rectify or change the direct current of our computer to be compatible with alternating current. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if we could somehow, and this is a very, very great potential for solar, if we can just harvest the direct current and not making these conversions, but just have a direct current house, we can actually take full advantage of the transistor revolution.
Well, thank you for letting me take that much
Well,
time.
Yes, okay. But here again, just to establish the bottom line, what the caller said is do you think that there might actually be a technological solution to this question of, you know, what if we have a point where we can actually generate energy, but there's not demand? We can generate electricity, but there's not demand. Is there some way that we could have, in effect, a giant battery and store it there when the demand comes? Or is it always going to have to be, no, you've got to deal with demand when it's, you got to have it when you got to have
it. Okay. Electricity is known as dispatchable power in that it's when it's produced, it's gone.
Yeah.
But what you can do, and it's very old technology, is when there's not a large amount of demand, you can push that water uphill with your electricity and then run it downhill to produce power when on demand. So that's a very low-tech solution. And they do that actually in France with nuclear power. Mm-hmm. Where they push it uphill, and then when it's more expensive in, say, the rest of Europe, they let it flow downhill, producing the electrons to make more money.
That's very interesting. All right. Well, we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and we have another caller, and several. Next is Belgium, line 2. That's the town. That's not all that far from here. Not the country. Line 2. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. They do that very same thing with water uphill in Michigan, at a place called Pentwater. They've done it for many, many years using excess power supply. Going to another point with your urban forest problem, there are many craftspeople now who do log the urban forest and make use of these trees that are being cut down to at least turn them into something usable. And to get clear to the beginning point of your show, you were talking about the interrelationship of solar power and trees. It is good to point out that they are the primary plant that does photosynthesis, which was really the original photo power type situation. And it does it much cheaper because it doesn't take a very expensive silicon. And it's interesting that we couldn't find some way to do it the way Mother Nature does.
Well, I'd like to say one thing is, because a plant doesn't rely on economics, the photosynthesis actually is a very low efficiency compared to, say, our silicon solar cell. It's only 1% or 2% efficient, but efficiency isn't a argument with a tree.
Okay, well, fair enough. Let's go next to Champagne, line 3, for another caller. Hello.
I guess my question doesn't border on being technical. It's a very generic question, and in connection with the environmental issues that are implied with what I've been hearing here, why do you think we tend to take a very light response to our being educated about what's happening in our environment, and especially the rainforests and the trees, and also global warming. I know that there's economics involved here, But are we doing a good job of informing people?
Well, I would say the media has done a very poor job, because the media, up till the moment, has suggested that this is a very controversial matter. And also you hear certain commentators say it's a left-wing, right-wing matter about global warming. But 50 years ago, you might say the modern research in global warming began at the University of California. In fact, at the turn of the 19th century, Svante Arrhenius showed exactly what type of temperature rises we would get from industrialization using carbon-based fuels. He predicted exactly what's occurring today. So, but what's kind of, I guess, makes me feel optimistic is that 2 days ago, Bill O'Reilly on the O'Reilly Factor said that he believed that global warming was a fact.
Well, with that comment from Bill O'Reilly, then I I'm with you. I think there's too much left-wing, right-wing kind of analysis. But most of the time when I hear these comments that tend to be, it's not really a problem, it comes from the right wing. And if he's saying it, then maybe people are recognizing. I find it laughable that we don't think that there's an issue here when you start, if you start reading what's happening to the glaciers at the North Pole, it's just amazing. And there is a problem. We really need to address it, quite frankly. I don't know what the solution is, but I think education is so important, and it was a delight listening to you this morning.
Well, thank you very much, and I always say ideology can act as a blinder.
I thank the call. Let's go to Farina next, line number 4 right here. Hello.
Hi. The government's and corporate actions to suppress these, actively suppress the kinds of alternative technologies, it rises to a level of criminality. When the oil companies are making their, excess billions in profits and then charging the excess amounts at the pumps like they have, and then I see my Ameren bill. It's 97% coal generated. Give me a break. Also, could you talk about the anything the Rocky Mountain Institute and Amory Lovins are doing? Thank you very much.
All right.
Okay. First of all, I'd like to say that, in all due respect, the biggest sponsor of solar research is the military. In fact, the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization is the biggest funder of cutting-edge solar research, and it's always been that way since the beginning. In fact, it was the U.S. Signal Corps that initiated the first practical use of the solar cell. So it's kind of a counterintuitive. Everyone thinks, the government, especially the military, right, because you never identify the military as left-wing. In fact, all the lights of the airports for our fighters in Iraq, for example, in Afghanistan, is all solar lit. All communications for the Army is solar powered. So we mustn't think that there's this conspiracy. And in fact, the first big user on land of solar was the oil industry for their navigation lights in the Gulf of Mexico for the oil rigs. And that's where we got the capital to build the solar industry we have today.
Let's go on. One more caller here, Matt Toon, line 1. Hello.
Yes. Mm-hmm. My name is David. I'm the Public Works Director for the city of Mattoon. I was listening to you on the way home, and I heard that Mattoon was going to cut down 8,000 trees on their boulevard. I just wanted to clarify that. We are actually planting trees. We planted more than we took down this year, but we did allow people to take down trees if they were causing problems. we had some gumball trees that were causing problems for some churches and stuff. So urban forestry, you know, it's something that does cost municipalities money. But here in Mattoon, we believe that the trees help us more than hurt us. So I just wanted to make sure that that was clear, that we're not just randomly cutting trees here.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you for the call.
All right. Bye.
All right. We have about 5 minutes left in this part of the show. I want to return to the subject I asked you before about the fact that you talked about the fact that for something like we've known about photovoltaics for something like 50 years. And I said, well, why isn't it every surface and covered with solar collection? And he said, well, one reason goes back to the days of our interest in promoting nuclear power, atoms for peace. And I'm sure people will get cheap to meter. Maybe people would have argued, well, we don't need solar. We have this other thing. Well, we know now that that's all of the problems connected with that. I guess I'm still wondering why it isn't now. We're not going out there and plastering every service with solar collectors. I mean, it still seems to be that I don't know if it's the issue is people are saying the cost per kilowatt hour is still too much and it doesn't make sense economically, or is it the technology isn't, people feel it's not quite there. I mean, it would seem like this would be the time.
Well, it all depends on your view. Like, for example, for myself, who's seen the development of the industry, I couldn't be more excited because the industry is growing at 40-50% a year. People are investing billions of dollars into the technology. You have a company in Norway, for example, which has just invested $700 million in expanding the production of the feedstock. You have in China companies that are planning to produce gigawatts. A gigawatt is a billion watts, which is equivalent of two or three power stations of solar panels a year. So it all depends on where you're looking. It's like a glass. If you hadn't had a drink for like 3 days and somebody offers you a cup like I'm looking at right now, you say, man, I'm just so happy to have that water. But then again, compared to how much electricity is generated in what we call the traditional ways, you're indeed right. But solar has been used for critical energy needs for the last 50 years. For example, satellites, which basically run our world today, are all powered with solar cells. Mm-hmm. For example, we wouldn't have cell phones. We wouldn't have DirecTV. We wouldn't have smart weapons if not for solar-powered satellites.
Well, what I think the expectation is that in the future, we will meet our need for energy in a variety of ways. It's going to have to come from a variety of sources because no one source is going to provide enough. What is anybody's idea about how much of our energy need solar could provide?
Well, actually, every day more solar energy falls on the earth than we would need to use in a year. What the predictions are is that by 2050, solar will provide about 50% of our electrical needs. Mm-hmm. Already, solar thermal, which people don't think about, solar heating of water, which seems so trivial, provides the equivalent of energy that's produced by 150 large power stations. In China, for example, you have over 30 million solar water heaters installed at the moment, and it's growing, it's doubling every year.
Well, what do you think it would take, and we're coming down to the last minute or two, what do you think it would take here in the United States to persuade more people to, more individuals, say, to look at that? Would you have to provide them some kind of financial incentive, a tax break, something?
Well, the program in California would be a good prototype. Mm-hmm. Very generous, but very goal-oriented in that they want the solar electricity to resolve major problems. And those major problems are what we call cutting peak demand. We call it peak shaving. Mm-hmm. And already solar is cheaper than electricity produced at the power plant during peak periods. So what you do, what I've learned about solar, is that you start at the most expensive level, and that provides a base to go further into a less expensive until, voila, it's doing everything.
Yeah. Well, we're pretty much at the point here where we're going to have to stop. I do want again to mention that our guest, John Perlin, who's visiting here at the campus for a couple of days, will be giving a couple of talks tonight at 7:30 in Allen Hall on the U of I campus. He'll be talking about the realities of solar power, past, present, future. This is at the main lounge, Allen Hall, tonight, 7:30. Then also he'll be talking about some of the things that he writes about in his book, A Forest Journey, The Story of Wood and Civilization. That will be tomorrow at noon in Turner Hall on the U of I campus. His visit here is sponsored by a number of units, folks at Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences, also the Environmental Council, Ag and Biological Engineering, and the folks at Unit 1. If you're interested also in, if you can't come to these talks, you can still go out and look for the book, Forest Journey, or he has also written two books that deal with solar power, A Golden Thread, 2,500 Years of Solar Architecture and Technology, and the other is From Space to Earth, The Story of Solar Electricity. Thanks very much. Appreciate it. Thanks for being here. The broadcast today is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta now offers a private dining room for parties, meetings, and other events. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. We are broadcasting from Campbell Hall for telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell. We are here weekday mornings from 10 to noon with 10 different topics every week. Just a quick reminder, tomorrow morning in our 10 o'clock hour, David Sinnoh will be here. He's a clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. And once a month, he stops by here and we talk about personal finance. So if you have basic kind of questions about investing, money management, personal finance, tomorrow's the morning to call. And then in the second hour, we will talk with Bassam Haddad. He is the director and assistant professor of political science at St. Joseph's University. He's also now visiting adjunct at Georgetown. And we'll be talking about the way we talk about Arabs and terrorism. That'll be tomorrow morning in our 11 o'clock hour. Right now, we will hand things off to Celeste Quinn, host of the Afternoon Magazine. She will take you through the rest of the afternoon.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with a musicologist. He'll join us to talk about early American music and the role it plays in Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House stories. Dale Cockrell will be our guest this afternoon. He's currently a professor of musicology at Vanderbilt University. He is an alumnus of the University of Illinois. He'll join us following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look at commodity prices now. In Kansas City, the March wheat contract trading at 482 and a half, up 5 1/4. In Chicago, March wheat 452, up 1. May 465 and 3/4, up 1/2. March corn 407 and 3/4, down 1/2. May 420, down 3/4. July 429, up 1/4. September 415 and a half, up 3. December 404 and 3/4, up 3 1/2.